It's another week and another big matchup in the Southeastern Conference, a top 10 matchup between Arkansas and the Vanderbilt Commodores this weekend in Nashville at Hawkins Field. The Razorbacks come into the series 25-8 overall, 8-4 in the SEC, tied for first place in the SEC West, ranked number 10 in the country. The Commodores are number 7. They are 25-8 overall, same overall record as the Razorbacks. They are a game back of Arkansas in the overall SEC standing, 7-5. The Commodores in second place in the SEC East. I'm Matt Jones. Thanks for joining us today on the Whole Hog Baseball Podcast. We'll talk all about this Razorback series against Vanderbilt. It's a big one, probably the biggest that the Razorbacks have played this season. Arkansas, of course, beat Auburn last week. The Tigers ranked number 15 at the time on the road in Alabama. But Vanderbilt, that's a different story. Vanderbilt's a team that a lot of people believe could be a national seed at the end of the season. They were number 1 in 3 polls, number 2 in 3 other polls coming into the year. And they played a tough schedule. They played some really good teams, lost a series to Texas A&M, lost a series to Georgia, but they've also got some quality wins on their resume this season. To help us talk about the Vanderbilt game, leading off today is Chris Burke. Chris is an analyst for ESPN and the SEC Network. The first game of the series this weekend will be televised Friday on SEC Network at 7 o'clock. On Saturday, it'll be on ESPNU at 8 o'clock, and Chris and Mike Morgan will be on the call for both games. Chris, we appreciate you joining us.
You got it.
Hey, Chris, you know, starting off, you were in Fayetteville last year for the Super Regional against South Carolina. You got to see Arkansas play quite a bit last year. I'm sure you've watched some of their games, you know, getting ready for these for this weekend's series at Vanderbilt. Just wonder kind of what are some of your general thoughts on the Razorbacks and maybe what you see that's different versus what you saw last year with all the players that they lost after the World Series.
Well, my general impressions with Arkansas are just very impressed at the level at which they're playing, considering, you know, not only did they lose a ton of production and some really good players, they lost their pitching coach as well. And so, you know, I think there was a lot to be excited about with what was coming back. But to be honest, and all three, Fletcher, Kerstad, and Martin have played well maybe here recently. And Fletcher's probably been the most consistent of the big three that were coming back position player-wise. But let's be honest, you know, Martin and Kerstad for, you know, a decent part of the season haven't played great. Yet Arkansas finds himself, you know, tied for the lead in the SEC West and, you know, ranked in for the most part, in most everybody's top 20, top 15, and certainly positioned to be a host and maybe go back to Omaha. So, you know, I've just been very impressed with Dave Van Horn's ability to not only replace the talent and, you know, the loss of Wes Johnson, but also just play at such a high level in a division of the SEC that is absolutely brutal.
Yeah, you mentioned Martin and Kerstad. You know, a lot of Arkansas's games this year, people will say, well, they haven't put it all together yet. The bottom of the lineup might carry them one game, or the top of the lineup might carry them another. I just kind of wonder your thoughts on that. It seems like this team has really not hit what a lot of people think could be its peak to this point.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, there's always some question marks when, you know, anybody following up a big year, but especially when freshmen who are surrounded by mature, older players have big seasons, it's always a little unpredictable as to how they respond. And, you know, Martin probably has been more inconsistent than Kerstad. Kerstad's numbers now, I mean, if you just helicoptered in right now and looked at his numbers, you'd say he's having a heck of a year. He's hitting 312 with 9 homers and almost 30 ribbies, and, you know, he's getting on base and doing the things that you would expect what I believe to be a future big leaguer to do. But you and I both know it wasn't real pretty early. And, you know, Martin, honestly, is probably always going to be a little bit of a up-and-down player. He's just a immensely talented, fast-twitch, super high-end athlete. But I think with that, you're going to get some you know, some peaks and valleys. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think if you're an Arkansas fan, similar to what you just said about the fact they haven't put it all together, you know, I think there is some room for really high-end optimism when you think that both of those two players are, I think, future major leaguers and really, really talented kids, and they're probably both just now getting going. On the flip side of that, you know, you got to be excited that Dominic Fletcher is, I think, you know, for the most part, been a rock this year, and last year was pretty ugly early on for him, and so he's been a lot more consistent. And so there are some bright. I mean, Trevor Ezell has been a fantastic pickup for them, and you know, Matt Goodhart, a young player who's playing at a high level, and so there's a lot to be excited about with the fact that Kerstad and Martin probably haven't gotten it fully going yet.
You played high-level baseball for a long time, Chris. I'm sure you've been through your share of hitting slumps. I wonder, what's that like when you're in the middle of a slump like Casey Martin had maybe been in prior to last weekend, and maybe your thoughts on how tough it is to break out of that, not only from a mechanical standpoint, but maybe a mental standpoint too.
Yeah, you know, baseball is a brutal game. You know, there's obviously very high-profile slump going on right now with Chris Davis in Baltimore. And, you know, there's not a whole lot that you can feel good about when you are a player that is expected to carry a load and you feel like you're not doing it. And so there's all these different phases of slumps. And there's the early part of it where most guys brush it off as, I'll get it going. And then there's the middle part of it where there's that bit of panic. And then there's the piece where you probably are trying to break out of it with one swing of the bat. You know, I remember I used to have to tell myself and still try to tell kids that I work with, like, and you know, a home run or, say, a big double or a big two runners on and two out kind of at bat, while we all want to do that and make that feel like it busts us out of our slump, those are still that's just one hit, mm-hmm. You know. And so, you know, really the only way to do it is to get in the cage, dig it out of the dirt, find something that you believe in from a feel standpoint or a technical adjustment standpoint, and then just try to take it up to bat with you every time. And, you know, I think the biggest part about being productive in this game is consistently knowing who you are and trying to take that approach with you every at bat. And so at some point, usually, you know, going back to the phases of the slump, at some point you grab onto something, you kind of block out all the noise, you find something that sticks, and you look up and you put 2, 3, 4 good games together, and now you can see, you know, kind of a new chapter unfolding. And so, you know, I think hopefully for Arkansas fans, you know, Casey going 4 for 5 on Tuesday, granted it's a midweek game, but that's something for him to build on.
Yeah, I thought so too. And he had a decent weekend last week against Auburn, had a couple of triples in those games. Wanted to ask you about the 15-inning game against Auburn last week. I don't know if you got to watch it or not, but I'm sure you've read about it or heard about it. Chris, I thought probably around the 11th or 12th inning that whoever wins this game tonight is going to have a really good chance of winning the game tomorrow, because it just seems to me, and I'd like your thoughts on this from a clubhouse perspective, when you lose a game that's 15 innings long, it's got to be just brutal to come back out 12, 13 hours later and be up to play another game.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the one thing I'll say about ball players is it's a pretty resilient bunch. Uh-huh. I mean, we're so used to failure and playing through weather and, you know, short turnarounds that, you know, some of that stuff's more for guys like me and you to talk about now that we're in the media than the players really care about. The truth is Auburn is really thin on the mound right now. And so the 15-inning game was going to probably favor Arkansas regardless of whether – or the day after a 15-inning game was probably going to favor Arkansas regardless, because I think Arkansas is a little deeper on the mound. The interesting part about that game is that I think is a good talking point. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't that game extended? Was it game one or game two that Auburn thought they won, and then there was a review and they changed the call?
Yeah, that was the 15-inning game. Auburn had they thought they had scored the game-winning run in the bottom of the 10th. And Arkansas threw the runner out at the plate, and they overturned it on review. And Auburn actually had dogpiled on the mound, and they had to get up off the mound and go back to their dugout and keep on playing.
Yeah, so look, I'm probably the biggest detractor of replay in all sports. But that's one of those that you just sit there, and we all know, you know, one of the things I love about covering this league is every single game, especially until you get to – the end of April, or maybe some of the stories have been written as far as a couple teams that are out of it. But every single game played by contenders is a playoff game. Every game. It's a 30-game playoff. Why? Because Auburn and Arkansas are both playing to host. They're both playing to be national seeds. They're both playing to win the league. And so you only get so many cracks at it, right? So if you got a play that literally determines who wins and loses, you're glad that you can review that. I don't know. I didn't get to see the replay. Was it obvious that the guy was out?
The players thought it was that, you know, they had a pitcher kind of standing over the plate when the tag was made. The Arkansas players thought it was pretty obvious, but the replay it was pretty close, but it looked like the catcher did get him on his elbow before he hit the plate.
So again, it was one of those calls that it wasn't egregiously bad, but again, it was a game-determining call. So you're glad there's replay for that. I'm just not a fan of it. I just feel like so often it's almost impossible to tell, and you sit there and say, "Can't we just play?" You know, and I just can't stand when moments are stolen. You know, you got a dog pile and you pull it off. But again, if the call was missed, I'm glad we have policies in place to rectify that. But that could end up being again, not to sound over dramatic here, but one game in this league can be a gigantic difference. And especially with Auburn's injuries on the mound, you know, that win for Auburn, if things go sideways for them, could be the difference between getting in the tournament and not, honestly. So fascinating game too there in that series.
Chris, I wonder what your thoughts are about Vanderbilt. There were, you know, number one, number two, depending on what poll you looked at coming into the season. They played really well, but they've also lost a couple of SEC series. How good are the teams that they've lost to, A&M and Georgia last week in Athens? And how good is Vanderbilt? Is this still a team that we think can has a pretty good chance of being a national seed?
100%. I would be shocked. You know, to me, them and UCLA, I would put as kind of locks to be national seeds at this point. I could probably tell you three or four other ones, but I think 100% Vandy will be a national seed. You know, their pitching is plenty talented, but not quite as refined as we're used to seeing from Vanderbilt. Been like that maybe the last couple years, where it's more stuff and less pitchability. And so because of that, they are searching for consistency on the weekend with their starters. Now, they're moving Kumar Rocker up to game two this weekend, which I thought was interesting because just a few weeks ago, you know, there was some conversation whether he would stay in the rotation at all. And now, you know, they're moving him up and bumping Patrick Gravy down. Mason Hickman has thrown really well for them on Tuesdays. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up finding his way into a weekend spot at some point. But, you know, look, they still got tons of guys that really show you some plus stuff. It's not a typical Friday night guy with Drake Fellows, but, you know, he's still 90 to 94 and has a good slider. When it's really good, it's, you know, he can pitch them deep into the ballgame. But the offense is world-class, and J.J. Blade is probably, along with Jake Mangum, the favorite to be the SEC player of the year right now. So, you know, a super talented team. They're leading the league in fielding percentage, which I would not have guessed to start the year. So you got to really credit Coach Corbin for putting the pieces together with a defense that had a lot of question marks to start the season.
I saw you post on Twitter. You're really excited about seeing the hitters this week.
Yeah. I'm a hitting guy. So I love watching talented hitters go about the task of what I believe to be the most difficult skill in sport. And so, you know, to watch Martin and Kerstad, Fletcher, and to get my eyes on some of the new guys from Arkansas, Azell and Goodhart, and then also, you know, watch Blade and be able to compare him to some of the great hitters that have come through this league and see where I think he stacks up as far as that's concerned. And I'm a big fan of Austin Martin as well from Vanderbilt. So Philip Clark, Stephen Scott. I mean, there's so many good hitters that'll be on display this weekend. So I'm looking forward to that.
You know, I know a lot was expected of Georgia this season, but I still am a little surprised at just how well they've done, maybe especially against the competition that they've played. I wonder what your surprises are, though, in the SEC this year. Is it Georgia? Maybe is it Florida and the start that they've gotten off to in conference play? Just some of your general thoughts about the league, Chris.
Well, I am a little surprised with Georgia because even as early as when conference play started, their pre-conference schedule was not very good. And I thought the national media was a little too bullish on them considering how much of their damage they lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, they lost Keegan McGovern. They lost Michael Curry. They lost Adam Sasser, which were by far and away their three best hitters last year. And so I was just a little concerned, and I wasn't – I mean, you don't know until you see it, but I wasn't sure that Emerson Hancock was quite as good as everybody had made him out to be from a prospect standpoint. Well, the offense has not necessarily eased my concerns, but Emerson Hancock has made as big a jump from year one to year two as Casey Mize made from year one to year two. And so – when you've got a kid that could easily be the number one pick in the draft, and he literally throws seven or eight innings every time he goes out, I mean, what that does to your pitching staff can't really be quantified, right? So he goes out there and, you know, last night was a really bad loss for them, but still he throws a complete game. He gives you all eight innings, you know? And so you've got a full stable of horses to go for two games. They'll figure out a way probably to win that series. And even though the offense isn't great, the arms are so talented. To me, it's a very – and they're playing good defense. I mean, last night they lost the game because of defense, but it wasn't recorded as an error. It was more of a mental error by the first baseman, Sullivan. But they're very similar to the Florida team that won it all 2 years ago. So I'm surprised at how well they've pitched. But now that I've seen them, I think they're certainly a team to be reckoned with. I think that I'm surprised Florida's as bad as they are, and I say that with all due respect because I still think they're going to be a regional team and won't be surprised if they figure out a way to win one. But I have never covered a Florida team who is in the bottom of pitching and defense. I mean, you look at their pitching numbers, it's shocking, you know. Where they're at in ERA, how few strikeouts they have, how many walks, where they're at fielding percentage. So it's really odd to see a Florida team. And then I'll tell you just a team that I'm really interested to see where the season takes them is Texas A&M, because they've got two of the best left-handers in the country, in John Deskaxis and Asa Lacy. Asa Lacy is one of the most talented pitchers in the country. And but their offense is pedestrian. So, you know, how far can their pitching staff take them will be an interesting storyline. And then is LSU, are they going to figure out their pitching? Is it going to get healthy? You know, Cole Henry and Jaden Hill are two of the best freshmen, but Hill's been hurt, and you know they are freshmen, so can you really lean on them? It's an older position player group that at times you know they beat Mississippi State on the road and you think, wow, that's a really good team, and then they lose 7-2 to Southern. So they've been a bit of an enigma, but to me the best bet in the West is Mississippi State. I just think that they have all the ingredients, and I love Chris Lemonis, their new head coach, so I'd be shocked if Mississippi State isn't in Omaha at the end of the year.
Yeah, Mississippi State comes into Fayetteville next week. That'll be one that I know a lot of people will be interested to see.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Hey, you're a Tennessee guy, Chris. Our friend Tony Vitello, what have you thought about the work that he's done in his second year in Knoxville?
You know, I've been really impressed with Tony by the way that he handles himself in the media. You know, what I like about him is that he really, you know, we all know that head coaches have to be measured to a certain degree just because of all the things that they're juggling. But by the same token, you know, as a member of the media, I do appreciate somebody who shoots you straight. You know, that's one of my favorite things about covering Kevin O'Sullivan from Florida is I just feel like he lets it rip and he doesn't worry too much about saying things that maybe other head coaches would.
Right.
And Tony's got a lot of that in him. I mean, he lets it rip and tells you what he thinks. And he knows that rebuilding in this league is a very tough task. And I'll be honest with you, I think he's in a tough spot in that you obviously have the monsters of, you know, Florida, Georgia, and Vandy, right? And so, you know, Serrano got that job. It was Florida, Vandy, and South Carolina. Right now, the three beasts in the East are Florida, Vanderbilt, and Georgia. And I will say Florida because Florida's they're not going anywhere. Like, this will be their down year, and they'll be right back to being a national seed next year. I really believe that. But Georgia's now got it rolling, and they're not going to go anywhere. And Vandy's had it rolling for, you know, 20 years, and they're not going anywhere. And South Carolina has too much history and too much pride. They're going to get back, but I think they're going to have a couple years that are down. So, you know, Tony's got a big job in front of him. And to be honest with you, what's interesting is, on one hand, you say, well, it's year two, so we have to be patient. But on the other hand, if you look at what he's using on the weekend, he's got Garrett Crochet, who's a sophomore, who recruited, who's going to be a first-round pick next year. And so they've got him for this year and one more. But he's got Garrett Stallings, who's a junior, who's going to get drafted and signed. He's got Zach Lingenfelter, who's a junior, who's going to get drafted and signed. He's got Will Neely, who's a senior, so he'll be gone. And then he's got Andrew Schultz, who's a junior, who's going to get drafted and signed. He's throwing 100 miles an hour out of the bullpen. So four out of the five guys that they lean on from a pitching standpoint will not be there next year. And so, you know, on one hand, you say, well, it's year two, and they're young, and he's just building it. But on the other hand, you say, man, he's going to lose about 80% of his production next year. And so I say all that to say I think he's a fantastic recruiter. I think he knows exactly what he wants and what he needs. But I do think it's going to be a 4, 5, 6 year process like we saw from Georgia to be able to really judge, is he going to be able to get over the hump or not? And to be fair to him, the expectations at Tennessee should not be anything faster than that. They really shouldn't be. You know, they gave Dave Serrano 6 years. I sure hope they give Tony the same leash.
Yeah, if there's anybody in there recruit their way out of something, it's Tony Vitello. He did such a great job at Arkansas for 4 years. Chris, before I get you out of here, last year you were in Arkansas for the Super Regional against South Carolina. You and Ben McDonald and Dave Neal, you gave Hog Knox just 15 minutes of fame. I wonder what you remember about that series.
Yeah, Hog Knox was certainly one of the stars of the series.
Yeah, we're way beyond impressive mode right now. This is almost superhuman what he's got going right here. I wish we could see what's behind the sunglasses. I don't think he's blinking either. I mean, that just looks.
Dude, how about my man's hat, though?
Huh? That's weathered for a little bit, but he's still pointing. It's the Supers, folks.
I just remember, you know, that was my first postseason event at Arkansas. And so, you know, to me, it really put them in my mind, which they'd always been there. It just sometimes you got to see something to to know it. It put them in the elite of the elite of college baseball programs and fans. And, you know, as great as Dave Van Horn's been there, you know, he's gone to, what is it, 5 College World Series. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's only the second time he's hosted the Super and gone to Omaha. Is that right?
Third time,
okay. And one of them, he kind of got fortunate because Missouri State was supposed to host. Right.
Yeah, Missouri State couldn't host because they shared a ballpark with a Double-A team.
Right. So, you know, I'm guessing it continues to up the fan base's desire to be one of those programs that gets that national seed so that they can count on, not that you can ever fully count on it, but you know what I mean, plan for hosting that Super Regional, because it really is one of the elite short list of venues for a Super Regional. Not only the facility itself, which, again, you know, I hear they invested more in, right? And they're now more – is there more suites down the right field line or something?
Yeah, it's planned.
Is that right?
It's planned. It'll be built by 2021. They're actually building a $25 million clubhouse, baseball office. They'll have suites in it. Yeah, it's quite the plan they have in place.
And when that's finished, you know, Mississippi State's got the bells and whistles of a condo, which I don't think anybody will ever match, but – you know, Arkansas at that point, I don't know that anybody will be able to stake claim to a better, when that's finished, a better full package of facility than they will have. Others will certainly be in the conversation. But so from a fan interest, from a facility standpoint, atmosphere standpoint, I mean, it's as good as it gets. And so to be able to be there and experience that, it was fantastic. And I'll remember that series for just how fantastic and passionate Arkansas's fans are, and how they take a backseat to nobody in that regard. Yeah.
Well, Chris, you've been great with your time, and we look forward to hearing you on the call this weekend for the games at Vanderbilt.
All right, I appreciate it. Looking forward to get my eyes on this year's version of the Razorbacks.
Chris Burke will be on the call this weekend. Arkansas and Vanderbilt, 7 o'clock start on Friday. That game will be televised by the SEC Network, 8 o'clock Saturday night on ESPNU. When we come back, we will talk with Vanderbilt play-by-play man Joe Fisher about this year's Commodores and about his relationship with an Arkansas legend, Paul Eales. All that when we come back on the Whole Hog Baseball Podcast.
WholeHogSports.com has the largest, most experienced staff of reporters covering sports in Arkansas. Football, basketball, baseball, recruiting, and more. You'll find it at WholeHogSports.com. The website includes up-to-minute news, daily commentaries, and award-winning photography from the staffs of Hogs Illustrated and the Democrat Gazette. For subscriptions, call 1-800-757-6277. That's 1-800-757-6277. Or visit us online today. WholeHogSports.com.
2-0 is hit into the air straightaway center field and hit well. Mangum going back to the track, to the wall. He leaps, and it's out of here. Let's play tomorrow. J.J. Blade with a walk-off answer for the Commodores.
Joe Fisher has been the play-by-play man for Vanderbilt football, basketball, and baseball for many years, and he joins us now on the Whole Hog Baseball Podcast to talk about this year's Commodores. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Hey, before we start talking baseball, about 13 years ago when Paul Eales died, I remember watching you do an interview with a local TV station there in Nashville. I can't remember exactly who it was, but I do remember very vividly you talking about Paul and the influence he had on you. And I just wonder if you could talk about that. I know that's something, you know, our listeners would love to hear, because Paul still remains, you know, such a beloved individual in Arkansas.
Well, he was certainly very important to me. I go back, I was very fortunate when I was a senior in high school in 1976. I started working part-time for then WSM-TV, the NBC affiliate in Nashville, where Paul was the sports director and was also the play-by-play voice for Vanderbilt. I was literally answering phones and getting coffee and just trying to get my foot in the door and learn more about the business. And Paul was amazing to watch and learn from because of the way he dealt with people. And you've got to remember back at that time, that was before computer, technology and ESPN and all those things. So TV stations really were the first line of information for sports fans if they wanted to call and find out scores of games or whatever the case may be. And so the phones rang all the time in the sports department. To hear Paul deal with these people on a day-to-day basis, as kind as he was, as busy as he was, to still make time for people was something that made a huge impression on me early. And then as time went on, to get to watch him around people and watch him do his craft and do what he did at Vanderbilt and then later on at Arkansas and stay good friends with him over a long period of time was very special to me. And I just said, I think probably in that interview, and I meant it when I said it, I think Paul Eales is probably the only person I know that I've never heard anybody say a negative word about. I mean, that to me is the ultimate compliment. He was a guy that not only was a pro in what he did, but he was tremendous in his day-to-day dealings with people. And I remember coming to Arkansas, I was at the funeral. I came and wanted to be there and visit with the family, got the opportunity to do that and pay my last respects. I remember the opportunity, the last time we got to talk to each other in person was a game that we played, in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. And he came into the football booth and we chatted for a little while beforehand. He came on the air with me for a brief time just to talk. And that's a very special man. And there's no surprise to me that folks in Arkansas still think as highly of him as they do, because he was a one-of-a-kind guy.
You've been at Vanderbilt for a long time. You've carved your own niche there. I think a lot of people, though, don't realize that, of course, Paul Eales was there for 11 years. Larry Munson was the play-by-play guy at Vanderbilt for, 20 years before he went to Georgia. I mean, you really follow in the footsteps of a couple of guys who, had almost larger-than-life personalities at two other schools. I think that's very unique about the Vanderbilt job.
It really is, and it's very humbling to think about when people start, running down the line of broadcasters. And as you said, Larry Munson, before his, glory days at Georgia, was at Vanderbilt for a long, long time. He also did television here. Back then, the process was if you were a TV sports director at Channel 4 or at some time at Channel 2 before that, the ABC affiliate, it was affiliated with the Vanderbilt broadcasting job. Those were combined. So it is, to think back on the history of this program and having those guys' names, and now I sat in the chair, I think, longer than any of them. I think I'm the longest tenured Vanderbilt broadcaster now. This is the end of my 21st year. It is a bit humbling when you start thinking in those terms.
Let's talk some about this Vanderbilt team, 25-8, 7-5 in the SEC. Very similar, I think, to Arkansas in terms of how the season has gone. Played a really good schedule so far. I know the Commodores have played A&M and Georgia and Florida. Just kind of what have been your overall thoughts of Vanderbilt to this point in the season?
Well, it's interesting hearing you say that. I had not really thought in those terms, but you're right in terms of the SEC. Vanderbilt has kind of run an early gauntlet, having to play A&M and Georgia and Florida, in the first 4 weeks of the season, along with a very improved Tennessee team. Yeah. It's a team that I believe, has all the tools. It's a team that certainly has quality pitching. It has quality depth in not only in the starters but in the bullpen. It has certainly offense. I think they're number two in the conference in batting average and in a number of offensive categories. It's a team where the defense is much improved, leading the conference in fielding percentage. That was an area of concern coming into this season. What hasn't happened yet with this team and what Vanderbilt fans hope will happen is that they put it together and all of those hit on the same cylinders at the same time. They have shown flashes. If you go back to the Florida series where the Commodores just dominated the Gators, outscored them 34-4. Across three games. Mm-hmm. That was the flash that Vanderbilt fans are hoping this team eventually ends up playing like in May and hopefully into June. They've got veterans on the team. It's a group that has a mix of some young players, but it's a team with five seniors. And that's very rare, you know, to have that many seniors at a program at this level. So they've got all the elements to make a run, to have a really, really, you know, special season, but they have yet to consistently put all those elements together.
I look at their lineup, and there's some really impressive names and guys that we've heard about at Vanderbilt for a few years. You know, like J.J. Bladé has 12 home runs. He's hitting .336. Ethan Paul, 40 RBI already at this point in the season. Austin Martin hitting .396, even though he's not necessarily an everyday starter, I guess. Just this lineup, it seems like there's not really a lot of holes in it.
I think that's one thing Tim Corbin would tell you, that one of the strengths is that there doesn't really seem to be a weakness 1 through 9. I mean, even you look most recently, Julian Fonte is one of those veterans playing first base who has really struggled offensively in recent times. Hit a home run last night, or hit a home run on Tuesday night, and is starting to swing the bat a little better. You know, Austin Martin's guy was hitting .450. He was leading the conference, and has hit a little bit of a lull for him. He was hitless in the Georgia series, but and you mentioned J.J. Bladé, 2 home runs in Murfreesboro against Middle Tennessee on Tuesday night. So he's the SEC leader in home runs, but he is a guy that bats for average. He has power to all fields. He's a tremendous right fielder with a great arm. And so I think he certainly has potential for the next level. But I think your point is well taken, in that I think one of the things you take when you look at this team is you can't look down and say, okay, if you can just get through this first 3 or first 4, then you get a little bit of a breather. That does not seem to be the case.
You know, every Friday night, Joe, you know this, doing baseball for as long as you have, it's usually a show in this conference when you get the pitchers on the mound. A lot of times you'll see 2 guys who are going to be big leaguers at one day. You remember seeing this 12 years ago in Fayetteville when David Price and Nick Schmidt went head-to-head, you know, in a big matchup at Baum. Drake Fellows, the number one starter for Vanderbilt. Isaiah Campbell's been very good for Arkansas. Just kind of what are your thoughts as you go in and you're going to see that pitching matchup?
Yeah, it's interesting, and you've been around it long enough. Usually, and it's not necessarily been the case this year, because I think the pitching talent has gotten better in the conference. The number of quality pitchers has gotten better. It used to be you would show up for that Friday night game and expect a low-scoring, you know, defensive pitching-minded kind of game. Saturday, maybe a little more offense, and then Sunday was wide open. You know, yeah. Sunday was going to be the 12-10 game. Well, that's not necessarily the case anymore. Drake Fellows has been the Friday starter. Vanderbilt has not lost an opening game in a 3-game series this season. They are perfect on the Friday night game. Fellows has been a guy. He's got quality, you know, 93 to 95 mile an hour fastball. He's got an excellent slider. He's got a great changeup. His strength this year, quite frankly, has been pitching out of trouble. For whatever reason, he has found a way in games, whether it be by a walk or a hit batsman or whatever, to kind of pitch himself into a bit of a jam, but then find a way to get out of it. You know, a combination of, you know, a big strikeout at a timely time, or relying on his defense, or getting the ground ball to the double play when he had to have it. Now, you're playing with fire when you keep doing that. Eventually, it's going to bite you. But that's kind of been his trademark this year, is battle through adversity, get through a tough inning. And it's kind of like, if you don't get to him in that inning when you have a chance, then he's probably going to settle in. And so for Arkansas, I'm sure they're thinking the same thing. If he opens the door a little bit, has a bit of a control issue, makes a couple mistakes, you know, try to make him pay for it and jump on it. Because if you don't take advantage, then he settles in. And the bullpen for Vanderbilt has been much better over the last couple of weeks, so they're much tougher to score on late.
Arkansas had the College World Series last year, finished national runner-up there. Heartbreaking way they lost to Oregon State. And, Joe, I've heard from a lot of Arkansas players who have said, you know, that's a motivation for us this year. Well, Vanderbilt, you know, they didn't make it to Omaha, but they had kind of a similar heartbreaking experience with the way Mississippi State beat them in the Super Regional. I wonder, how much does the way last year ended, do you think, motivate this team this year, especially with there being, you know, so many third- and fourth-year players?
You know, it's interesting. I'll be honest with you. I've not heard it discussed. Now, that doesn't mean it's not in their minds, and it doesn't mean that as we get closer to that time of year that it might not come up again.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that for the most part, a lot of folks, the memory of that Super Regional against Mississippi State, even for Vanderbilt fans who lost, was that might have been the most outstanding Super Regional series ever played. I mean, it had everything. It had all the drama all the way through. And as you said, the way the whole thing ended, I mean, right down to as close as it could possibly be, home runs and great plays and all that. So I'm not so sure that it's a motivation to get back just because they think maybe they were not robbed of it, but just they were that close to getting back for a fourth time to Omaha and had it taken away from them. But again, as they get down closer and get into regional play, then you start reliving some of those moments some of those guys will. And as you said, the veterans like an Ethan Paul, that's back, like a Drake Fellows, like a Julian Infante, those guys that have been there and had the opportunity to be that close, it may be in the back of their minds. But the other thing that I think Tim Corbin kind of reiterates to these guys is that was that team, this is this team. Mm-hmm. It's a different element. You've got to live in this moment and not live in the past. But, I'd be hard-pressed to think a veteran player doesn't remember how close they were to making their fourth trip to Omaha.
Tim Corbin and Dave Van Horn, they're tied for second in tenure in the SEC behind Mike Bianco at Ole Miss. Tim Corbin's influence on Vanderbilt, how can you put it into words? Because he's really turned that program into just such an outstanding program, one that's taken it to new heights than I guess it had ever been before he got there.
No, he clearly, I think the way you say it is, he clearly built the program.
Yeah.
It was, when he came, he took over for Roy Newbern, had been there for over 20 years and had done, some good things, but he inherited a place that had just built Hawkins Field, was just trying to get baseball on the map. Vanderbilt kind of basically making a commitment with Tim Corbin to see if they could become a player in the SEC. And what Tim Corbin has done, and I hope he writes a book on it one day, and I don't know if he will, but if he does, every coach in America should read it, because he has built a program and built a culture. It is now, Vanderbilt baseball, if you're looking for, the program, that you can point to and say, this is how you do it. This is how you do it right. And this is how you do it in all aspects, not just on the field, but with former players, with facilities, with everything that goes along with it. Tim Corbin has done it. And I think maybe the most telling factor in that, and I think any coach would tell you that one of the most beneficial things for them is to see a player that goes on to success, at the major league level or in professional baseball, that wants to come back and stay connected to your program, that wants to continue to be a part of your program. And I would say what Tim Corbin has done at Vanderbilt is almost unprecedented in that he was one of the first that I know of, and I've heard other schools do it, has built a locker room for the professional players to come back to Vanderbilt to work out prior to spring training, to be there, to be on the field in Hawkins Field, to be in the workout facility, to be in the cages, to be, in the lab, wherever they need to be. They have a place there for them to come back. And it's amazing how many of those guys not only come back, but how many of them actually move to Nashville to be here to stay connected to the program. When they built new facilities, which they just completed a year or so ago, the number, the percentage of former players that contributed financially was extremely high. And as you guys know, as I'm sure former players as a rule don't really give back to the programs at a very high level. That is not the case with this program. It's been an amazing thing to watch. And for me to have done all the games over the course of this time and see the development to a point where now every year, year in and year out, when you talk about teams that are going to compete for a national championship, that are going to compete for a chance to go to Omaha, pretty much every year now when the year starts, you've got to write Vanderbilt on that list.
Arkansas's coming into Nashville this weekend, Joe, coming off a series at Auburn. And I think the way the Hawkins Field lays out, it reminds me a little bit of that park at Auburn. It's got the big wall in left field. It's kind of got that little funky crevice with an angle there in left center. But Vanderbilt's very good, and they seem to play to their park really well. I just wonder if you can kind of tell our listeners who maybe haven't been there or who haven't watched a game there, just describe that park to them and maybe why Vanderbilt plays as well as they do there.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons for it. One, you mentioned the wall in left field, because it's a short porch in left field. You know, it's under 320 feet down the left field line, but the wall is about 35 feet high. It used to be just a solid green monster-like wall made of, you know, aluminum and all of that. Now with the renovations and the building behind it, the new offices, it is a sort of a glass and screened wall that you can still see that they play off of in left. And for a left fielder who has not played in that situation, it's important for opposing teams to come in and for a left fielder to go out there and take some balls off that wall, you know, figure out how the bounces are. So certainly for Vanderbilt, it's an advantage for our left fielder who plays there all the time. There is the little crevice in left center, a little cutout in the wall there that can sometimes provide a bit of an awkward bounce. Straight away is 400 feet. It's pretty basic. And then down the right field line, it's a little bit more of a poke. It's about 335 down the right field line. The wind is a big deal, you know, at Vanderbilt. And, you know, some days there is no prevailing wind where you show up every day and you know, okay, the breeze is going to be blowing this way. It always changes. And even in the course of a series, you can come one day and have a breeze howling in from left that's really favoring the pitchers. And the next day come and have it howling, blowing out to left, which means it's going to be a challenge, you know, for the pitchers that day. The other factor I would say is the totally turfed surface that we went to a number of years ago. There is not a speck of dirt on the surface at Hawkins Field. Everything, including the pitcher's mound, is turfed. And so that takes a little bit of getting used to, but I've never heard an infielder complain about it, because you don't usually get a bad bounce. You know, it's not like, you know, you hit that gravel and you hit the seam on the infield and you get that bad bounce. It doesn't happen at Vanderbilt. You usually get a true bounce. It's a fast surface. They built it that way. They wanted it to be quick. So it favors teams that have speed. And one of the things you'll see that's always kind of intriguing is guys that aren't accustomed to it, a lot of times base running, will slide into a bag and slide right through it, you know, slide right over it, because the turf is so quick. And so that's something to pay attention to in a series. Guys that make a base running mistake like that can be costly. But it certainly is a field that I think you would think is a home field advantage, and I guess that's as it should be.
Joe, before I let you go, are the Whistlers still there?
Yes. Oh, yes, indeed. They're not going anywhere.
I've read some stories where maybe even some Vanderbilt fans, you know, aren't fans of the whistling because it gets on their nerves or whatever. And I just wonder, kind of, what are your thoughts about them? Because it seems like, you know, whenever Vanderbilt's playing on TV, it's not the game that gets discussed; it's what's going on in the stands.
Yeah, that's true. I can see both sides of the argument. It's interesting. I've heard Keith Corbin talk about it, and then he says the players actually notice it and like it. And so it doesn't bother them in the game. And if it encourages them, then I would say that's probably something that should continue. But, you know, I can understand, you know, from an ESPN standpoint or, you know, an SEC Network standpoint, with their microphones there, they're picking that up all the time. I can see where that would be, you know, a bit of a challenge. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's not somebody that's being obscene. It's not somebody that's, you know, doing anything that's untoward that you'd be embarrassed about. It's just, it is what it is. And, you know, so, I mean, and we're seeing a trend around the country now in Major League Baseball with fans that are getting into that, you know, the Ric Flair, you know, woo, you know, yeah, chant. And so it's always something like that. I mean, how many places have we gone where, you know, teams have their own quirk, or they have that one fan that kind of leads the cheers and makes the noise? I think we're all better served just kind of living in the moment for enjoying the excitement of the game and not being so turned off by something that can kind of get on your nerves a little bit.
Well, Joe, I appreciate your time and hope you have a good time this weekend. You're getting a lot of top 10 matchups this year with Vanderbilt. Hope you don't get spoiled by that.
Yeah. in this conference, you're going to get a bunch of those.
Joe Fisher, the Vanderbilt play-by-play guy. We appreciate your time, Joe.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, some final thoughts on the Razorbacks' week that was. We'll talk about the series win at Auburn, the midweek win over Oral Roberts, and we'll look back a week ago to the loss to UALR and some thoughts on that game. We'll be back in a moment on the Whole Hog Baseball Podcast.
Want more coverage of your home team? Download the Whole Hog Sports Video On Demand app, presented by Absolute Heat and Air. Check out the all-new Fan Zone and get up-to-the-minute videos on football, basketball, baseball, recruiting, and more. Search for Whole Hog Sports on Apple TV, Roku, and Amazon Fire at home, and take it with you on the go by downloading it for your mobile device in your app store. The Whole Hog Sports Video On Demand app is presented by Absolute Heat and Air. For the absolute best service, trust Absolute Heat and Air.
I mean, we just beat each other up so much on the weekend, honestly. We use so much pitching, and it seems like everybody's so good this year on the weekends that, you know, midweeks are, you know, you want to develop guys, but you need to win games. You want it to be fun, but sometimes it's just agony, honestly. And I mean, LSU's lost three games to in-state schools this year already. And it's, you know, you're running into teams that are excited to play you, and you know, you're trying to keep the kids focused on the Tuesday game, and really they're thinking about the Friday game or the Thursday game. And it's a tough pull there, especially this time of year. And the Tuesday and Wednesday games have been a battle for a lot of teams, including us.
Welcome back. As we close out the show today, some thoughts over the Razorbacks' last five games. A loss to UALR, a series win at Auburn, and a midweek win over ORU earlier this week in Fayetteville. First, for the UALR game, a lot of people lost their minds over Arkansas losing to UALR. The first time Arkansas has ever played an in-state team, you know, the expectation was that Arkansas would win that game, that the Razorbacks would be up for that game, and they would certainly never lose their first game to an in-state opponent. Well, that wasn't the case. And, you know, I think UALR's record at the time maybe caused people to have more of a negative reaction about it than they should have. If you look at the Trojans, though, they've won seven of their past eight games. They had won three straight coming into Fayetteville, and of course Arkansas was coming off that series loss to Ole Miss and having some trouble with their pitching staff. Talk about that here in just a second. But UALR now, after their win over Arkansas and after their series win last week in Sun Belt Conference play, they also had a midweek win this week. They've got the number 63 strength of schedule in the country, and they've got the number 131 RPI. That's not great, but it's not the same as losing, say, to the likes of UAPB, who's going to come into Fayetteville next week, or even LSU lost to Southern the other night in a rare road game where LSU went across town and played Southern, lost that game 7-2. It's not the same as losing to those type teams. UALR is a team that very well could compete for the Sun Belt Conference Championship. And when we talked to Chris Curry prior to that series, he talked about how he liked how his team had competed. They had a lot of 1- and 2-run loss games to the likes of Mississippi State and Northwestern State, who's a very good mid-major program in Louisiana. They had played Ole Miss. They had played Oklahoma State. They had played a very good schedule up to that point, and so they had seen some good teams. Arkansas wasn't the first good team that they saw. I don't think that's going to change anything about Arkansas playing in state competition. You know, Arkansas and UALR are already scheduled, I believe, for two more years to play in 2020 and 2021. And Arkansas, you know, they want to keep playing UAPB too. It's not going to change that. That's gonna stick. And you know, losing to UALR, even if Arkansas were losing game to UAPB, it's not going to change the hierarchy, obviously, of baseball within the state. Those games are convenience games. Those are games where you get into April and teams have trouble scheduling, and they don't necessarily want to go on the road because the weather is nice or nicer all over the country. And, you know, the teams who spend, say, 16 days on the road to open the season, they're trying to catch up on their home games this time of year. And so when you can play teams from within your state, whether it be Arkansas against UALR, UAPB, or LSU playing Southern, saw Texas A&M lost to Texas State this week. Those are games that teams need. They need to be able to schedule those. And losing to UALR, even though it's not great for Arkansas, it really hasn't hurt the Razorbacks a whole lot. They go into the game, I believe Arkansas's got the number 4 RPI in the country, and they've got the number 8 strength of schedule. So you're going to see that game be played. And And I think UALR's got a chance to really make some noise down the stretch. That was just a matter of a team that was struggling in Arkansas coming into a game against a team that was playing really well in UALR. Midweek games, they're tough this time of year, especially to a team with injuries in its bullpen or that is shorthanded in its bullpen for whatever reason, like Arkansas is. Jacob Kostyshok won't be available again for the Vanderbilt series this weekend because he's got inflammation in his throwing elbow. There's a chance he might be able to return against Mississippi State. And what that does is that it essentially makes you use pitchers who wouldn't be pitching otherwise on the weekend, and then obviously that has a trickle-down effect to whenever you get into the midweek. It's not so bad when you only have one midweek game, but say like in a couple of weeks when Northwestern State comes into Fayetteville, they're going to play two games, and if you're having trouble finding pitching on a Tuesday, imagine what it might be like on a Wednesday in that series against Northwestern State, not only for Arkansas, but for both teams. You know, teams are dealing with arm fatigue and injuries at this time of year, and you know, it's not something that's just limited to the Razorbacks. You saw that against ORU the other night, 15-8 win by the Razorbacks over the Golden Eagles. Both teams, by the end of the game, were throwing, you know, just their back of the bullpen pitchers. Heck, ORU, they'd thrown three position players on the mound. It was pretty crazy to see just the mixing and matching that their coach Ryan Fulmar had to do, going and taking his right fielder, bringing him in to pitch, or going and getting his first baseman and bringing him in to pitch. So it's tough on teams all over the country right now. Against Auburn last weekend, I thought that was Arkansas's most impressive series win of the season. You think about the fact that the Razorbacks, it appeared they had lost the game. Auburn scored a run in the 10th off of Cole Ramage, and all of a sudden you think Arkansas has blown 2 3-0 leads in the same day against Auburn. The call is overturned, and I thought Arkansas really showed a lot of grit and determination in those final innings and in the extra innings. And not only the extra innings, but even the 8th and the 9th inning when Matt Cronin came in and pitched his way out of a couple of jams, got him out of a 2nd and 3rd and 1 out in the 8th, and got them out of a bases-loaded jam with 2 outs in the 9th. Every pitcher came in and they did their job in that in the 15 inning game, and then the next day in the 8-0 win that Arkansas had to win the series. You think about Kevin Copps; he got the loss earlier in the day. How many times do you see this? The same pitcher gets the loss and then a win in the same day. Well, that's what happened with him because he got the loss in game one, had given up the go ahead run in the 8th inning after Arkansas had blown the 3-0 lead in the 6th. And then he comes back later that night and he gets the final 4 outs and looks really good doing it. I thought that was a great turnaround for him, especially given that you know, he's been kind of the tough luck loser in some of these games recently. Cole Ramage, I thought, was really the pitcher of the game. Came in and gave Arkansas 75 pitches over, I think, 4 2/3 innings in the extra innings. Just ran out of gas at the end. Loaded the bases in the 14th inning. Copps comes out. He gets one ground ball out, and then a moment later, Heston Kerstad hits a home run that puts Arkansas ahead, and the Razorbacks go on to win in the 15th. But I thought Ramage did a really good job. Matt Cronin, obviously, working out of those two jams late in the game. Cody Scroggins, I thought, did really well. Came out of the bullpen, you know, and picked up Connor Noland after he was able to go about 4 2/3 innings. Scroggins pitched 2 2/3 in game two, came back the next day and gave him an inning. And I think that's kind of Scroggins' role right now. With Jacob Kostyshok out, they need that long relief pitcher, and I think that's what Cody Scroggins is going to give them. They'll go TBA for game three at Vanderbilt again this week, so that, let's say, Connor Noland doesn't have a great outing, or maybe he can only go 4 or 5 innings, as has kind of been the case with him lately, then Scroggins could potentially come in. Depending on how the game is going, or maybe they're able to hold Scroggins for game three, but he gives them a lot of flexibility in their bullpen. And then finally, the change in the batting lineup, I think, has really helped Arkansas the last couple of weeks. We talked with Chris Burke earlier in the show about the struggles that Casey Martin has had this year. Well, you've seen in the last 5 games that they've taken Martin out of the leadoff spot. They batted him 2nd against UALR. That didn't go too good. He was 1 for 6. And so for the Auburn series and against ORU the other night, they moved Martin down to 3rd, put Kerstad at 2nd, and Trevor Ezell is now batting leadoff. Ezell's batting well over .360 in that leadoff position since they put him in there. He's taking a lot of pitches, getting on base, and Kerstad is doing a good job of driving him in with either home runs or or doubles. He's been one of the better hitters on the team over the last couple of weeks. But what I think the biggest change has been Martin, 4-for-5 against ORU the other night, of course. That's against midweek pitching and against ORU, I know that. But against Auburn, I thought he played pretty well too, had some big hits throughout that series, a couple of triples, including one in the first inning of game two that led to an Arkansas run, got them on the board quickly, not too long after they had blown the lead in that first game. And some thoughts this week from Nate Thompson and Casey Martin about the change in the batting lineup. First, Nate Thompson.
You know, we had a lot of good options to hit leadoff or three hole. We just, I guess, felt like the time was right, maybe to try something a little different and take some pressure off of you know, some guys, and, you know, let Casey feel a little more comfortable maybe in three, you know, and let Ezell, you know, who works counts really well and stuff. Maybe see if that wouldn't translate a little better for him in the one spot. Casey, it's no secret, he loves to pull the ball. And, you know, I just think that sometimes he tries to force, you know, he wants to do something special. So he tries to force stuff. And sometimes that makes him be pull dominant. And it's, you just have to take what the pitcher's going to give you. And you have to try to, you know, we call it like shifting the field a little bit and trying to work, you know, just let the ball get deeper in the zone and not keep the ball in play, you know? You know, and that's not just a thing for him. I mean, that's a thing for all hitters. I mean, so, and he has, you know, the thing we keep preaching to him is he has the ability with the bat speed and talent that he has to not have to try to pull the ball. Like he can focus, you know, deeper in the zone and still get the bat there on an inside pitch just fine. So, and not everybody can do that, but he can.
And now here's Casey Martin.
Yeah, I definitely feel a little bit better, but I think tonight was more of just the approach I kind of took to the plate. I was thinking more right center gap and trying to hit the ball, let it get deep and hit it to the right side. And kind of if you do that, it allows you to deepen it up a little bit and come right into my bat path. So, I mean, I'm not pulling balls foul. Instead, I'm hitting them in between the lines, whether it's left field or right field or in the gaps.
It should be a great weekend. Arkansas and Vanderbilt both 25-8 overall. Arkansas enters the series 8-4 in the SEC and a three-way tie for first place in the SEC West. Vanderbilt is 7-5, and they are in second place in the SEC East. Statistically, these two teams are very similar. Vanderbilt has played a little bit tougher schedule than Arkansas, especially in SEC play. We'll see how much that comes into play this weekend. Again, game time 7 o'clock on Friday. That game will be on the SEC Network, 8 o'clock on Saturday on ESPNU, and then a 1 o'clock finale Sunday on the SEC Network Plus. It's going to be raining all weekend in Nashville, so there'll be a chance that some of those game times can get changed. Stay with us at wholehogsports.com, and we will keep you updated on any game time changes, plus all the coverage from this weekend in Nashville. Until next week, I'm Matt Jones. Thanks for joining us.